Well, we come to the second part tonight of parents' role as disciplinarian. Can somebody tell me in your student syllabus what page that is? 38. Okay, so take your stuff and turn to page 38, if you will. Page 38. Oh. Parents' role as disciplinarian, part two. And if you remember last time, we're not going to do a ton of review. I'll just remind you that we walked through the principles of biblical discipline, beginning with what to put off. So wrong motives, wrong mentalities, wrong methods, and then ending with the right ones. So basically summarized as love. If you missed that, you can catch the recording of it online. Tonight, we want to turn a corner and get really practical. So we did the principles last time. This evening is going to be much more, I hope, practical as we discuss how to apply these principles in your home with your children where the rubber meets the road. Okay? So that's what we want to do tonight. And we're just going to jump right in because there's a ton of stuff to cover. And hopefully we can leave a little bit of time at the end for Q&A and Pastor Kerry said he might try to make it back in here for that. But if he, you know, like if I'm in the middle of answering a question, everybody just kind of nod and act like I did really well. Just kidding. All right, so look at your syllabus here. As we start discussing the practical side of discipline, the way your syllabus frames it up is that biblical wisdom is wise. So, of course, you know that wisdom in the scriptures is the wise application of the principles that you find in the Bible. So hence, it gets very practical from here on out. And if you notice in your, if you just scan your syllabus, you'll realize that they're breaking this down, this section, into three characteristics of wise biblical discipline. That wise discipline is reasonable, it is definable, and it is useful. And they spend the bulk of the time on that third one, which will do the same as well. So that's kind of how we're going to walk through it. So let's just start talking about it. First, characteristic of wise biblical discipline. Wise discipline is reasonable. Some other words maybe you could use here is understandable and attainable. Bruce Ray, if you remember, we've been quoting from his book, Withhold Not Correction. He says this. He's actually got a great chapter on this. It's chapter 9, if you ever decide to buy that book. It's called Correction Within Reason, and it's really a helpful chapter, but I'll just quote a little bit from it. He says, biblical correction must be applied according to reasonable expectations. Again, the model for all of our correction as parents must be the chastisement by which God corrects his spiritual seed. And he quotes Psalm 103, 13, 14 declares, just as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. And he says, why? For he himself knows our frame. He is mindful that we are but dust. And so then he goes on to say this, we must learn the frame of each one of our children. They are each unique physically, spiritually, and emotionally. There are many highly individual factors which must be considered when we're dealing with our children. And I think that's a sort of captures it a little bit, that we understand this, we know our kids, and that our expectations in our discipline of them match what we know about them, that they're reasonable and they match sort of the pace at which they're growing up and maturing. So Bruce Ray goes on in that chapter to give two helpful questions, and I'll give them to you as well. Two helpful questions to measure the reasonableness of your rules. And you might want to write this down. First is this, are they physically capable of meeting our expectations? That's for your kids, right? Are they physically capable of meeting our expectations? In other words, are they tall enough? Are they strong enough? Are they coordinated enough? And he says, not every spilled glass at the dinner table is the result of being careless. Some of it is. Some of it is, to be sure, but not every one. So reasonable expectations. You know, just another example of this, Even in your commands to your kids, we've had to be careful at times, and we're not perfect in this as well, but here's an example. Instead of saying, go to sleep, hey, buddy. This is parenting. We're all used to it. We got it. Instead of the command, go to sleep, we've learned to say, hey, lay down and be quiet. Because there's a difference, right? To say, go to sleep, how are they going to obey that? Can any of us literally obey that? There is something a little bit unreasonable about that, right? I mean, and of course, with flexibility, you understand what that command is, but maybe let's be more specific. So, are they physically capable of meeting your expectations? That's the first question. Second one he gives is, we must also ask if they're mentally capable of meeting our expectations. And in other words, a string of complicated instructions only given once may be unreasonable for a two-year-old, right? Ryan, what is going on back there? I think he needs a new diaper. Maybe. Parenting 101. We'll try to cut that out of the recording. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it was far away enough. So, all right, bring it back here. We're talking about reasonable expectations. But Bruce Ray also wisely qualifies this principle in that chapter, and we're going to have plenty of points tonight, but with also plenty of clarifications and qualifications. And he qualifies this idea of reasonable expectations by saying this: yet this principle must not be used as an excuse to avoid discipline. Got to be careful of that too. All too frequently, we're willing to say, I find parents to be this way, that our children cannot understand or do what we expect them to do, right? Have you heard that before? Well, they just don't understand. You know, it's a good excuse, but we've got to make sure that we really understand. We really know that they actually can't understand. I think a lot of times that becomes an excuse for parents when the kid actually really does understand, you know, more than you realize. So I think that's particularly a temptation, that excuse, for first-time parents of young children who aren't, they don't quite know and they don't quite realize how much their child comprehends and grasps before they can actually properly communicate. So those two things, you got to understand that happens. Like, kids develop and they understand much more than they can actually communicate, at least in a certain season of their growth. And just because they can't tell you what's going on doesn't mean they don't understand what's going on. So I think first-time parents don't realize that because they're first-time parents. And the reality is they know, your kids know more than you think. Ted Tripp reminds us this in Shepherding a Child's Heart. He says, rebellion can be something as simple as an infant struggling against the diaper change, or stiffening out his body when you want him to sit in your lap. You have no way of knowing how, or like kind of arch the back, you know, that's the, when we're trying to buckle him in. He says, you have no way of knowing how much of what you say a child a year old or less can understand. But we do know that, and here's what I was saying, understanding comes long before the ability to articulate does. So just understand that if you're a first-time parent. Your temptation, he says, will be to wait until your children are able to speak, or speaking and able to articulate the rebellion before you deal with it. And by then, it's going to be way too late, way too late. So let me offer another clarification here, though. Just because we're seeking to be reasonable in our expectations of our kids doesn't mean that we don't set the bar where God sets it or expect obedience. But here's what I mean. I will still expect my three-year-old to obey me when I tell him to clean up his room. But if he misses like a stray stuffed animal in the corner, if his bed's not like crisp and clean, like ROTC kind of folded, it's like, I'm not going to discipline him for that. So that's kind of the this first one. Wise discipline is first reasonable. Okay, so just make sure you understand where your child's at. And maybe your temptation is to err on one side or the other, but just that's the challenge. That's the wisdom that's needed. Okay, that's principle number one, characteristic number one. Number two, and again, these first two are going to be much faster than the last one, but wise discipline next is definable. It's definable. I'll give you some other words here. It's clear and measurable. Clear and measurable. Again, Tripp observes this in Shepherding a Child's Heart. He says, a biblical approach to children involves two elements that you weave together. One element is, and here's this one, rich, full communication. Okay? The other is the rod. In the book of Proverbs, we find these two methods side by side. You have to communicate clearly to your child and not just spank them, right? Why is this so important? Here's why. Because being definable in the discipline process mitigates against anger, because ambiguity often leads to anger for everyone involved, not just the kid, but also for you, right? And I think this is so common that, again, for first-time parents, but even for us, in seasons, that we as parents often struggle to know when to discipline our children because our commands actually aren't clear enough. We might have this in our minds, like they shouldn't be doing that. But we've never really clearly articulated what that is and why that doesn't, what they just did and what this whole situation is resembling, why that doesn't, why we feel like we need to do something about it. But you gotta remember, the child may not have ever been told that clearly. And so it's like, what should I do right now? You know, oftentimes I find when I have conversations with parents who are just like, I'm not sure when to do this, when to come down, when to not. A lot of times you could trace that back to your commands and your expectations, they haven't been clearly enough defined. Because clear expectations make it very clear if those disobedience has occurred, right? So I'd say definable discipline keeps us from being confused about whether or not to discipline, waiting too long to discipline, and then potentially piling on consequences out of frustration. So what do I need to define? What do we need to define? Two things, okay? Two things you need to define. Number one, you need to define the rule that you're giving or making. You need to define the rule. In other words, make sure your rules are specific enough to be measured, okay? Spell it out for them. Be as detailed as possible, right? Example, instead of clean up your room, say, throw away all the trash, put the cushions back, put the toys in their proper bins. And that's a little bit more definite, right? Clean up your room, that might for one kid be like, okay, yeah, I put that piece of paper in the trash. I'm done. So be specific, be more specific. Here's one I like. Instead of stop it, or even we've caught ourselves using this one recently, excuse me. And it's like, well, what are they supposed to do with that, right? You know, they just need to read the tone of our minds and be like, oh, I need to stop this right now. Like, and be more specific about what you want them to stop, what you want them to replace that behavior with, okay? They don't know what to do with a stop it or excuse me, you know? Stop breathing, so what do you want me to do? Stop, okay, so you understand. Sam Crabtree writes this. He says, he gives a lot of really good ones here. Listen to these. Express your warning to the child clearly, not vaguely. If you throw the truck, I'll get the rod. Not if you don't shape up, I'm going to get angry. Or if you aim that Nerf gun at anyone, I'll take it away. Not be careful with that thing, right? Because careful for a child's like, yeah, I'm careful, you know? Carefully shooting my brother, you know? or if you continue using that tone of voice, you'll be sent to your room. Not settle down, right? That's also pretty ambiguous. Or specifically, when you whine, I automatically deny your request. Are you whining? Not, your whining drives me nuts. Okay? So those are all good examples of what to say and what not to say under this. Because what we're after is our commands that are easily measured and clearly communicated so that we know when a child is disobeying. And it becomes very, very clear. And I would say the younger they are, the more specific and spelled out the application should be. You know, I was thinking about this. Actually, I've thought this for a long time, you know, and I don't have one verse to back this up or anything, but if you think about the Old Testament law, just how specific it was to the nation of Israel, I kind of think of it that way. Like, I kind of think of it as training wheels. In some ways, when God is teaching his people about himself for the first time, codifying the law, he has to spell it out so specifically. When this happens, this is what a gracious response looks like. When this happens, this is what justice looks like. And it's like, why were they so specific? And you read through, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and it's like, and then you get to the New Testament, and it's like, well, here's how you sum it up. Love one another. The spirit of the law. And it's true. That's what happens. Because as there's more revelation out there, and we can look back and look and see, oh, those are the training wheels, and then, but these are the principles. And so I think the same thing happens with our children, right? You know, as they're in the beginning, you need to, you can't just give them the principle, expect them to know how to apply it. You have to apply it for them. You need to give them the concrete scenario. And then as they grow and flourish in their understanding, they begin to connect the dots. And then you get to press in on the heart issues. So that's kind of my theory, okay? All right, so define the rules. Number two, define the response, okay? Define not just what you expect them to obey, but also how you expect them to do that. Define what it would look like for them to respond in obedience. In other words, make sure they understand what an obedient and disobedient response to that command that you've just given them looks like. Which means helping your children understand that obedience should be a few things. It should be right away. It should be all the way, not incomplete obedience, right? And it should be with a submissive attitude or heart. Now, we used to say this. Now, maybe you've heard this before. We used to say with a happy heart. Ever heard that before? And I realized, like, from, you know, one of my pastors back in Jupiter said he amended that years ago to this submissive attitude because he realized, like, well, you know, that could be misleading. Like, they should just be walking around with this huge grin on their face. And not necessarily. That God sometimes asks us to do things that are difficult. And he doesn't expect some superficial sort of happiness on our face while we're doing, but he does expect a submissive heart. So there's that's kind of why we word it that way. So right away, all the way with a submissive heart. Ted Tripp actually puts it this way. He says, obedience is doing what you're asked. And I like this too, without challenge, delay, or excuse. Those are good words too. Here's how you're not going to do this, without challenge, delay, or excuse. We have said similarly, without arguing, complaining, or delaying. So those are the same kind of things. Or even more illustratively for a child's understanding, to summarize what an obedient response looks like, we've even said before, look with your eyes, listen with your ears, respond with your mouth, obey from your heart. So look with your eyes, listen with your ears, respond with your mouth, obey from your heart. This is kind of how we've at times communicated this. Obedience, in other words, you just think about this. This is very biblical, though. It requires the whole person. I know we want to teach our kids that, lest they become Pharisees, right? Obedience requires the whole person. All the faculties are engaged, Deuteronomy 6:5, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. So be clear about your rules, be clear about the response. Define rules, define response, okay? Those are the two things I think we need to be clear. But how do I make sure my expectations for obedience are clear? Let me give you three practical tips under this, okay? Number one, secure their attention. And a lot of times that's, hey, look at me, right? It's look at my ass. Typically that's how we get their attention. If they're not looking at us, then we know they're not hearing us, or oftentimes. So secure their attention. Tell them early and often. In other words, remind them in advance in more than one way of what's about to happen and what your expectation of them is. You know, and I was also thinking of, you don't have to turn there, but just, you know, the start of the book of Hebrews. Remember what Hebrews says, Hebrews 1:1, that God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions, in many ways, in these last days he's spoken to us in his Son. And then he gets to chapter 2 and he says, hey, for this reason, we need to pay much closer attention to what we've heard so that we don't drift away from it. There's this idea that you've heard it so many different times from so many different people, and now even his Son. And the point there is, and here's just even the parenting principle, is here's what I'm trying to do. I am raising the accountability, and I am binding their conscience to what I'm saying. That's what I want. So that it becomes so evident that they have to cross this line in order to disobey. So secure their attention, tell them early and often, and then number three, require a response from them. Require a response from them. At the very least, expect them to give you verbal acknowledgement, like, yes, Mom, yes, Dad, something like that, right? Yes, some of you are Southern, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, you know? But however you want to do it, require a response of them. Just don't let them use the what. Like that's pretty disrespectful. Our kids have done that, gotten used to that sometimes, and then, no, that's not how you respond. How do you respond? Yes, Mom. Yes, Dad. So require a response from them, or even better, have them repeat your instructions back to you and ask them questions about it to make sure they understand. Again, loading their conscience. It removes the excuse, I didn't hear you, right? And it's like, well, you literally just repeated these words back to me. And inevitably, we will still hear that, because all they'll do is they're just mouthing the words like, yes, yes, let me get this over with, and then I'm off to my thing. But it is interesting to me that both the Hebrew and the Greek words for obedience are related to that idea of listening. So we're always telling our kids, listen, you need to tune your ears to Mom and Dad's instructions and voice. That's a very biblical thought. Okay, so we're talking about definable discipline. Having said all of that, let me give four clarifications here. Okay, I don't know if these are in your notes. I don't think they are. Let me give four clarifications for you here. We're going to get into the weeds here a little bit. Okay, clarification number one: sometimes, not always, but sometimes, even if the child didn't hear you and you think they should have, you should still discipline them to teach them, like I just said, to tune their ears to the sound of your voice, okay? Sometimes there does come a point where they are selectively cutting you out and they just need the reminder, they need the discipline to remind them once again, oh, I actually have to pay attention. I need to listen for my mom and dad's voice, that the Bible actually requires me to do that, okay? So Ted Tripp is really helpful here. He says, I've never challenged the validity of the statement, but I didn't hear you. But I have taught my children that it was not acceptable. One of our children seemed to have much trouble with hearing. We sat down with this child, had this conversation. You're having trouble hearing. I'm speaking to you in normal conversational tones. I'm in close enough proximity for you to hear me. I think, therefore, that you better start to develop the ability to pick my voice out of the other noise in your world. When you hear my voice, you should perk up your ears. From now on, if you fail to obey me because you did not hear, I will spank you for failing to listen for my voice. And we only had one spanking for failure to hear. After that, the hearing problem cleared up. I think that's helpful, okay? Clarification number two. Requiring a response is not the same as asking for consent as a parent, okay? We're not seeking to gain the permission of our child to command them, nor are we asking them to agree with what we're telling them to do. We just want to know that they heard, okay? So don't give them a suggestion unless you're truly leaving the decision up to them. So don't look for consent by saying things like this. Pick up your clothes, okay? We do that sometimes. You know, we we used to have this habit. And sometimes if we caught one another doing that, the other parent would come in and say, no, no, mommy, I will not. Not okay. And it's like, what am I supposed to say to that? Like, you gave me the option. You asked me, is this okay? It's not okay, mom. It's like, don't give them the option. That's not an option. You're not asking for consent. You're giving them a command. You're telling them to do something and then requiring them to respond so that you know that they heard you, okay? I just did it right there, okay? So,
no.
Yeah, no, we're not going to do it. I have no authority over you guys, okay? Listen. Clarification number three. In the event that in the event that your child is truly convinced that mom and dad are misreading the situation, teach them that they can respectfully appeal if they do it the right way. And I would say this, if they first demonstrate submission, okay, they need to obey first, ask later, or at least, I would say, have a submissive response first, like a verbal yes, mom, and then follow up with a clarifying question. Can I say something? Or can I make an appeal? Can I please tell you something? Because I mean, the reality is, yeah, we don't always see the situation fully accurately, and you know, they may not, you know, something may actually be going on, and you know, but you've got to teach them to first respond submissively, and then make their appeal, right? And then clarification number four. This does not mean we get sucked into a debate with our child about the reasonableness of a rule or, you know, the fine print on something or how we interpreted something wrong. I mean, sometimes when that happens, right, you begin to realize that you actually weren't as clear as you thought you were. So, okay, point taken. I'm going to be more clear next time. Nevertheless, you still need to obey. Right? So, but we're not getting into this back and forth of why and, oh, you weren't clear. And you're a parent, not a hostage negotiator. Okay? This is not a negotiation. This is not a debate. In the end, your child needs to learn to submit his or her will even when they disagree or think that they know better than you. And they need to learn that. They need to learn that. Again, this is not, you're not just trying to be heavy-handed or squash them, but it is good for them to learn that, because we need to learn that as Christians and just people, that the Lord oftentimes puts us under authority that we don't agree with, and that tests our will and our humility. Crabtree says, would you apply corrective discipline? You don't need to fish for proofs or arguments to back up your rules or standards. You already have what you need, parental jurisdiction under God. And I will add this, the heart that refuses to obey unless it agrees with the counsel that you're giving them is, we have said this to them. Here's what's going on. You're being wise in your own eyes, which is not a good thing. It's a phrase found all throughout the Proverbs, and it's a sign of pride. And we just tell them, look, you're being wise. Don't be wise in your own eyes. You just need to trust mom and dad right now. Okay, you don't always need an explanation that you agree with in order to obey. They need to learn that, okay? So that is definable. The last one is the longest, I think, here. And that is wise discipline is useful. The other word I would put next to useful here would be effective. Would be effective. And this is the longest because in the rest of this section, the syllabus gives six marks, basically, of useful discipline. Six marks of useful and effective discipline, okay? So let's walk through them. Well, does it? At least, I guess did I make up the six marks? Do you guys have six marks? No? Yes? Is it clear in there or no that there's six marks? It's not? All right. Well, I made them up for you. There. I think I just read through it and then categorized them myself. So I'm trying to organize the material in a way that's more understandable for my own brain. So I trust they fall. Well, maybe they don't, but I would think that they fall in this order in your syllabus. So the first being give effective or useful discipline gives rewards for obedience and consequences for disobedience. Is that kind of the first thing that you see? All right. See? So in other words, here's this rewards for obedience, consequences for disobedience. And that seems really basic, but it's grounded in the principle of cause and effect, right? Or the Bible would know it as sowing and reaping. Galatians chapter 6, don't be deceived, God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. I mean, you could go to the end of Deuteronomy and read this over and over again, and you know, chapters 27, 28, even on to 30, where God is literally telling Israel, look, here's what's going to happen if you obey, and here's what's going to happen if you disobey. I'm going to set before you life and prosperity, death and adversity. Which one do you want? You could cause, effect, obedience, disobedience. I want to teach my child that he has a choice between the blessings of obedience and the consequences of disobedience. That's what this is all about. So, a couple of clarifications here. Okay, clarification number one. Be sure that you are rewarding obedience and not disobedience. And you're saying, well, that seems pretty obvious. But here's what I mean by that. In other words, you should never give your child what he or she wants just to get them to stop doing something that they actually shouldn't be doing. You ever see parents do that? Like, hey, stop doing that, I'll give you candy. It's like you're not bribing them. You're being manipulated at that point, right? They're disobeying, and then they're going to get a candy or some reward to stop their disobedience, and that's not okay. That's actually going to backfire on you in the long run. You're rewarding disobedience at that point when you should be giving a consequence. Disobedience needs consequences, not rewards. Rewards are for proactive, I would say, the putting on of something that is that your child does that's unsolicited response of selflessness and service and thoughtfulness, that's what rewards are for, in my opinion, right? So disobedience, though, needs to be met with consequences, not bribery. Go back and read in that Parenting with Loving Correction, Sam Crabtree, page 77 and 78 on this. Okay, he gives really good examples of that. Making sure that you're rewarding obedience and not disobedience. Clarification number two here, be sure that your consequences are sufficiently and appropriately painful. We'll talk a little bit more about this here in a minute, but just think about the language of Hebrews 12, okay? Hebrews 12, 11 admits that for loving discipline to be fruitful over time, it needs to first be sorrowful. It needs to first be sufficiently painful in the moment. That's the biblical logic. If it's not sufficiently painful or sorrowful in the moment, it's not going to bear the peaceful fruit of righteousness for the long haul. So make sure that your consequences that you're bringing for disobedience are actually sufficiently and appropriately painful. And we'll talk more about that here specifically. But here's some couple common questions maybe that come at this point. So how do you know when your discipline is sufficiently painful, is firm enough? It's a good question. Again, it's going to take some wisdom, and it may be different per child, but think about this. Actually, listen to what Bruce Ray says here. He helps us with these diagnostic questions. Here's some questions. Do our children laugh and giggle or play when they're being disciplined? If that's the response, he says, then we're probably not spanking them hard enough. Here's the other one, and that this is one. This one's a little bit less intuitive. Do they get angry and cry out against us? He says, then we've probably not disciplined them firmly enough. That's an interesting one, right? We'll talk about that here. And he says this, the marks of biblical discipline are grief and sorrow, not laughter or anger. We provoke them to anger whenever we fail to discipline them with sufficient firmness. Now that isn't naturally our response. So that's really important. He says we need to learn to recognize with each one of our children that point, and here's the wisdom of the balance, where we have brought grief and sorrow for their rebellion, for grief and sorrow are the marks of biblical discipline. That's our goal. And you kind of know, right? With your child, what's an angry scream and cry and what's a sorrowful one? But question number two then is related to that. I've had this before, right? What about a child who fights you during discipline and spanking them just seems to make them crazier? You know, a lot of times people get to that point and they're like, just seems to be worse. And again, let me just remind you, perhaps this is counterintuitive, but this may be an indication actually that you may not be disciplining with sufficient firmness, and they may not actually be being brought to a point of sorrow and grief. They're just angry, they're just annoyed or frustrated that they had to get this consequence, but they're not grieved that they've received this consequence. So in your other book, the blue one, the Ricketts, they say this. One way to tell whether it is sufficiently painful is to observe the child's reaction to it. If administering the rod just makes the child angrier and more rebellious in their heart, then it may not have been painful enough. So they agree as well. I think that's just really interesting. And here's what I would say to that. Here's why this is important. Never excuse greater rebellion. When a child kicks against their parents' discipline, that needs to be corrected all the more. I mean, your child needs to learn that if they, here's the biblical language, if they stiffen their neck and they harden their hearts, that it will not be well with them, that more severe consequences are going to come. That's how God deals with his people, right? If they stiffen their neck and they harden their hearts, they will be shattered more quickly. God is opposed to the proud, but what? He gives grace to the humble. So at the same time, I'd say they, if they humble themselves, if they soften their hearts, if they confess and they forsake, Proverbs 28:13, they will find compassion. Not that they will necessarily avoid discipline, but that they'll at least receive compassion. And all of this, again, let me just say, requires great wisdom, care, and balance. And I think, listen to Sam Crabtree's wise words here, spankings, and here's the balance then, should not injure. That's the other side. Spanking should not injure, but it should hurt. That is, administer pain, a sting. If it doesn't hurt, guys, it doesn't deter. And the child doesn't consider it worth avoiding. So here's the line. Discipline inflicts pain, but not injury. There's the balance. Pain, but not injury. That's where the wisdom is, right, for us. So let's get even more practical then. I'll give you four practical considerations on this issue then. You're saying, okay, so how hard is too hard? How much is too much? What do I use? Those kinds of things. Practically, let me just say some implications from this. Choosing your implement that you discipline with is important, because it ought to help you achieve this goal. It ought to be painful. So again, not a pillow. It's not a pillow fight. It has to be painful, but also, you know, not a hammer, right? You're not out to injure your child. So that, like, automatically you're thinking, okay, so it can't be heavy and it can't be rigid, and it should probably have a surface area that's spread out enough so that even if I put some force behind it, it'll sting, but it won't go deep, right? It won't ultimately break a bone or anything. I mean, God forbid that, right? So it's, and it should be probably flexible to some degree. But that's important. And, you know, I was kind of debating, you know, if I should bring the thing that we use from our home and show it to you guys. I did bring it. I don't think I'll pull it out right now, but if you're curious, you know, we just use this little, it's a flat, it's almost like a leather thing, kind of a bunch of leather glued together, and just, it's about that big, and it works really well because you don't have to do much for it to sting, and it's not gonna injure your child. So choosing what implement is really, really important. Practically, choosing the right number of swats is important, I think. Again, I've talked to parents before who, this is their discipline. No. And it's like, that's not going to do it. You know, that's not sufficiently painful or a deterrent enough. For us, a basic sort of, if they've disobeyed and they're getting just the very normal baseline default, for us it's 3, and this is 1. That's 1, 2, 3, and then it's over. But so it's
not like that though.
Not like that. I'm not like giving them a. It's not a golf clap. I'll just say that for sure. But that's what we do. And that works for us. Again, there is no Bible verse on this stuff, but I'm just trying to practically just bring it down to the where the rubber meets the road of these principles, okay? So choosing the right number of swats. practically choosing the right part of your child's body to discipline is also important. And, you know, there is a place where God just has, by his design, put extra padding and no vital organs to damage. So, you know, it's typical, right? You spank their bottom, the behind. And it's hidden. It's naturally padded. It's, you know, by the way, take the diaper off, right? I mean, because it, like, so those diapers, it's just like, it's a natural, it's just, it's not going to be effective. It's just like, poof, like, you're not going to get your point across that way. And then practically choosing what environment to discipline in is important. I think make sure that it's private and not public. And for us also, it's typically, you know, it's a designated spot for that. You know, we send our kids to the bathroom. They just sit in the bathroom, you know. So, yeah, just make sure it's private. You know, that it's away from the other kids. You know, you're not, I don't want to discipline my child in front of everybody. And that includes their brothers and sisters. You know, I just want to give them as much of an opportunity to humble themselves and not have to worry about other people watching and being embarrassed and that kind of thing. Okay? So effective discipline first gives rewards for obedience and consequences for disobedience. Second mark that apparently you don't have there. It must be enforced in a timely fashion. It's got to be there in somewhere, okay? Enforced in a timely fashion. Sometime after the rewards and consequences, there should be a timely fashion somewhere. All right. God always does what he promises, right? His yes is always yes, his no is always no. So as parents, I think we just need to follow through the very first time. You know, and this is where it gets hard sometimes because we are lazy and we'd much rather just yell at our kid from the couch and not have to get up and deal with it. But, you know, listen to Sam Crabtree says, if we want our child to respond the first time we speak, think about it. We must demonstrate that we always mean it the first time. And he says, if you make a pattern of delaying enforcement or just repeating your warnings without acting on them, you're teaching the child to disregard your initial instructions. So three don'ts here, okay? Don't make it a habit to resort to coercion through counting or raising your voice or changing your tone, what Bruce Ray calls the early warning system. Don't do that. No early warning systems, okay? Your syllabus, page 41, says, parents undermine God's expectations when they allow children to linger in disobedience. But, you know, you've heard people say, I'm going to count to three or five or maybe tomorrow it's 10. I don't know. It's like, and if you, it's like, here's what that tells me. Oh, mom and dad actually don't want me to obey until they hit three. I mean, that's just what we're teaching them. Maybe unintentionally, and we wonder why they don't obey the very first time we just give the command. Well, because we haven't started counting yet. So don't do the early warning system, and I think that happens, maybe even if you're not counting, just even if it's a change in your tone. So if mom and dad say it this way, I can disregard them. But if they raise their voice and they look at this, and they, now I gotta obey them. So now I'm teaching them, look, I don't have to obey until that happens. And so Riquette writes even more specific, look, if you give a command in a normal tone of voice, but then repeat it in a firm or elevated tone of voice, if your son doesn't obey, he learns that what you really expect is obedience when you elevate your voice. So don't do that. No early warning systems. Second, don't. Also, don't wait until there are an accumulation of little things and then try to correct them all at once. That's also not helpful. You know, like try to scoop them all up with one spanking. be specific and timely for each instance of disobedience. Bruce Ray says this, a good spanking at the end of the day can never make up for the spankings that ought to have been administered throughout the day. And, you know, that's dangerous too, right? Because at the end, you might just be at the end of your rope. You might be exhausted. You might be flustered. There's just more temptation to discipline out of anger at that point because you're fed up, you know. So don't do that. No early warning system. Don't accumulate little things and try to correct them all at once. Third, don't promise something you can't or aren't willing to follow through with. You know, there's some good examples of this in your syllabus there, right? On your vacation, you say, hey, if you don't stop, we're going to turn around and go home. You're not going to really turn around and go home. You just spent all that money on Disney World. You're not going to turn around and go home. Don't say that. So there's some helpful things, I think, under that one. All right. Third mark of useful effective discipline must be appropriate to the child's age and maturity. Appropriate consequences can be anything from spanking to removal of privileges to even more work and labor. And the point here is simply this. These should match the child's ability to understand what is going on and associate the consequence with the sin. It's kind of like the equivalent of what the one we heard earlier about, hey, make sure that your expectations and your rules are reasonable and matching your child's maturing level. This is the same in one sense, that the consequences are understandable to their maturity level. Which is why I would just say, I mean, even in God's wisdom, the younger the child, the more direct, less sophisticated the consequence should be to get the point across. That's why spanking is so helpful. And as they grow, consequences can certainly become more sophisticated, and they will. The reality is spanking is the best consequence for younger children because it's the easiest for them to grasp, to connect to their wrongdoing, and it's the simplest for the parent to control and to administer. So again, Ted Tripp says, the rod is the careful, timely, measured, and controlled use of physical punishment. And we, you know, if you weren't here last week, we try to make a case for that, that we have to use the rod as parents. It is God's wisest provision, and it is the only form of discipline that he prescribes to parents, and I think for good reason. So it's an act of faith, okay? But here, two common questions that come, right? And you're probably anticipating them. How young is too young? When do you start? I think, you know, I was reading some guys on this. Ted Tripp puts it simply in his book, Shepherding a Child's Heart. He says, when your child is old enough to resist your directives, he's old enough to be disciplined. For example, a child who can't talk yet still can glance around, you can tell, and see if you're there before he does something that he knows he's not supposed to, right? So he's expressing that disobedience, even though he can't articulate it. But here's the balance. I think Sam Crabtree in that other book that we gave you, he says this is very good. Don't punish newborns. And that should be intuitive to us, but we have to say it. He says, don't punish newborns. It's the extremely rare baby. And you're saying, that was my baby. It's the extremely rare baby who can comprehend his offense during the first few months of life, much less make an association between an offense and some resultant punishment. And then he goes on to say, let me hasten to add that children just a few months of age can begin to arch their backs in defiance of their parents, and such defiance can and should be met with correction. So I would say, like, if push came to shove, you know, on our kids, maybe the five of them, I feel like the age just got younger and younger each time, but maybe around 6 to 10 months old, you begin to realize, you know, as kids start getting mobile and stuff, but even before that, you where it's appropriate, you start flicking the hand and they're reaching for an outlet, right? Tapping the mouth when they scream in anger, swatting the thigh when they're not staying on the changing table. And a lot of times those are the sort of first forms of correction. So it's not a full-blown spanking. It's not, we're not sending them to the bathroom like I just said. You're like, okay, roll on over there. Just, but so those are mainly behavioral and immediate. But that's how it starts, right? So, but no newborns, of course. But as they begin, you'll see around 6 months, they start to do that. And that's appropriate, certain forms of it. Question number two, though, how old is too old? Is there a point where we ever stop spanking in the home? And this is controversial. Maybe Carrie could enter in on this a little bit. But I know a lot of people, they have different views on this. Some, in fact, it is the one thing in Bruce Ray's book, Withhold Not Correction, that I actually disagree with. He suggests as long as your kids are in the home. So he actually advocates spanking even teens. And we do not recommend this, okay? And that's just, this is us. We would agree with your other book we gave you by the Ricketts. They write this. If you want to read more on the page 134, 135 of Purposeful and Persistent Parenting, here's what they say. As children get older, the use of the rod tends to taper off, right? You remember Carrie's graph? As parenting interactions with children transition from basic skills of obedience to things like responsibility and others, orientation, and deliberately talking with them about their heart issues. And here's he says, older children are able to learn from consequences like the loss of privileges or their disobedience, for their disobedience, because they're old enough to mentally process the connection between their disobedience and the consequence, even if not corrected immediately. So how have I answered this? I mean, I was asked this even after the very first parenting class here by someone in this room. Personally, my suggestion is here's my suggestion. Keep the rod on the table and around as long as possible, but it's case by case for each child with this principle in mind. Spanking is no longer appropriate or effective when it is producing more shame than it is pain. So that for me has sort of stuck in my mind as there does come a point where your child reaches an age where pulling down their drawers is a bit shameful, and you'll realize that. And it's not as painful, and it's just not gonna be as effective. There are other forms. And I think by default, I would imagine that typically comes around or just before puberty. So that's how I've answered that. I don't know if Carrie wants to add anything to that. I know.
I say 30 to 35.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So Carrie would be in that other camp, but I'm just kidding.
Still in his own.
Yeah.
If they come to visit, they're in my home.
Yeah, that's right.
Holidays are a little different in our house.
Joel James has a helpful PDF online that I've given out to people even recently. I found it recently. It's Parenting Rebellious Teens, where he talks about how would you handle older kids, and it's very, very good. For older children, he lists four categories of consequences: restrictions for acts of irresponsibility, labor for acts of disrespect, financial consequences. His point there is don't fund your children's freedom to rebel. Don't fund their entitlement, their attitude. If they're disobeying you, like, you don't need to give them money. And then restitution when their sin has caused loss to others. I think that's helpful. Restrictions, labor, financial, and restitution. But you can just Google Joel James Parenting. It's the very first thing that comes up. It's a PDF that you can download, and I printed it out for Melissa and I to go through with just as we come up on that season. All right, number four, effective and useful discipline should be proportionate to the nature of the offense. In other words, the severity of the consequence should match the nature of the sin. So this isn't so much about the maturity of the child anymore. Now this is the focus on the sin. Is the consequence, in terms of its severity, matching what happened there? Because the precedence of this is the Old Testament, right? Not every sin receives the same punishment. We understand that. And Bruce Ray says, the fact that discipline must be sufficiently firm to impress the lesson does not mean that it must be equally firm for every lesson. And I think a common question here comes is spanking only for serious offenses as a last resort? The answer that I've given is no. Actually, Riquette says, if you only use the rod as a last resort after the child's crossed some kind of arbitrary line that's determined mostly by how annoyed or angry you feel, then you'll almost always be angry at your child when you're administering the rod, which is counterproductive and potentially dangerous for them. So, Riquette suggests spanking for three kinds of sins specifically: willful disobedience, lying, and attacking another child. But the severity of your spanking might vary in the number of spanks received, or it may be coupled with some other consequences and losses of privilege. So that does happen, right? And we will add to, or again, I told you earlier that our baseline is three, but then if they're like on the way to the bathroom and they slam something, it's like, hey, you just earned yourself another one. So there's severity. All right, number five, effective, useful discipline must be done in love and with self-control. And that's all I'll say about that one, because we've already talked about that. Last, number six, effective, useful discipline must be consistent. It must be consistent. In other words, don't keep changing your standards. Don't keep moving the target. Try to always discipline for the same things in the same way. Crabtree says, don't keep shifting his boundaries. Don't keep moving the line he's not supposed to cross. Every time a child steps over that line, you correct. But if you keep moving that line, then he no longer knows where the line is. He'll bounce all over the place, constantly testing your limits because he's never quite sure where they are. And that's helpful. So not only don't move the target, but don't just discipline for big sins, right? Discipline for every sin. Every sin. Two common questions. Should we discipline for attitudes? Yes. We should discipline for anything that God would view as sin. Second common question. Should we discipline for house rules that have no direct biblical principle? Like don't come into the kitchen while mom's cooking, or no running in the hallway? I think yes, if you've clearly communicated them. Because at that point, they're disobeying mom and dad. Ephesians 6, children obey your parents. And practically speaking, household rules will help you to not discipline out of anger when something happens, right? Like because a child's made a mess, because they're being foolish. Some of your house rules could actually mitigate some of that and curtail some of the foolishness. So it's a wise exercise of parental authority. So anytime your parents cross, or your children cross that, you discipline. All right? All right. So that's it. Those are useful and effective principles for discipline, practical guides. And if after all of that, you're still struggling, Bruce Ray's advice is just hang in there. Be faithful. You know, if you sit down and you troubleshoot all your discipline, you're saying, and you've asked, hey, am I giving the consequences? Am I doing it in a timely manner? You're troubleshooting it with your wife. Look, do my kids understand what's going on? Is it sufficiently firm? Are we dealing with anger in our own hearts? Have we been consistent? If the answer to all those things is yes, then be faithful. John and Cindy Riquette say, press on in faith. Some children are more stubborn than others. Sometimes it just takes time and consistency. And don't lose heart of doing good. So, any questions? Yes.
All right, let's help me understand. Let's go back to the anger thing about if they're getting disciplined.
Yes.
And they become angry.
Mm-hmm.
They should be grieved. If I'm dealing with unregenerated children.
Yes.
Am I to expect that they would be grieved by their sin versus them just being angry at how I?
Yeah. No, good question. I don't think it's necessarily, we're not diving into 2 Corinthians 7, godly sorrow, worldly sorrow. Like, I get that, but there is a basic difference between I'm angry and annoyed that I got this consequence, and I'm sad and I'm sorrowful that I got the consequence. So it's still over the consequence, but there is a difference of sometimes, like, That's why I think it's so insightful that they were saying, look, if it's not sufficiently firm, you're just producing annoyance. It's that, get this over with. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we? But as opposed to, I wish I hadn't done that because I wouldn't have gotten those. And that's the difference. So the heart attitude, it may not be, we're not necessarily looking for, because you're right, that kind of sorrow of real repentance in the converted soul. Of course, yeah, ultimately that's the goal, but that kind of sorrow may not come that produces, salvation. Does that help? There is a distinction there. One is a fruit of the Spirit that only God can produce, right? But there is a kind of sorrow and grief, I think, that is distinct from just, I'm angry.
I mean, just think about adults. Lost adults can grieve over something. They can have regrets and they can have sorrow.
Yep.
About that they've hurt somebody.
Yep.
Just by God's common grace, we're all made in the image of God. So, yeah, it's not a theological sorrow of, associated with regeneration and things like that.
Right.
Is there a case where, there are just really rebellious children or kids that maybe their temptation is towards anger, and the more you do it, the more they get angry, you're on the verge of actually harming them? Like, do you just bring in other consequences down the line at that point, or, how would you handle a situation like that?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think that takes a lot of wisdom. I think one tool is certainly you can compound different kinds of consequences that don't always have to be spanking. So we've done that before. I think, again, if you're doing it the way we described, it's probably, the threshold's probably higher than you think of I'm going to injure my child. I'm just saying that, maybe. Now, again, I don't know the kid, obviously, and there may be a unique circumstance. Carrie, what'd you say to that?
Yes, you don't want to keep just doing something and keep upping the, tightening the vise tighter and tighter physically, where now you're causing tissue harm, and things like
mm-hmm.
that. And you are producing more and more anger. So, yeah, at some point you have to be faithful to do it. But it may be a combination with other circumstances, other consequences, and you're understanding that you're going to live to fight another day. There's going to be another opportunity, and you can try again. Just a couple of comments about that. There is no sort of perfect box with a bow tied on it
mm-hmm.
that you follow all these things. We live in a fallen world. It's messy. You're not going to make the best decision sometimes. You're going to be too strict or too lenient, but you keep at it. And overall, there can be this pattern of faithfulness that you start seeing some results in your child. So just trust that. Mm-hmm. One of our sons had an anger problem. And he was angry, I'd say from about six or seven, we began to notice it, and till about 11 or 12. It was several years. And a lot of it was, because his brother, his older brother produced a lot of it. There's a 5-year difference and they share a bedroom together. And but this younger son, and now you know who it is, but this younger, I'm not going to name any names, but this so-called younger son, I mean, you know, he put a hole in the wall one time, you know, out of anger. So we had to deal with the older brother as well, you know, his sin of what was the word?
Provoking.
Provoking, yeah. But it didn't change overnight, but I can tell you he's not like that today. Mm. You know, he began to, as he matured, sort of even out. So along the way, we probably didn't do everything perfect, but we just kept doing, as Kevin just said, just kept being faithful to do what was right. If it needed discipline, we disciplined it. If it didn't cure it all of a sudden, we didn't look at it and say, well, we didn't do the right thing. That was the right thing. We had a clear conscience. And we had to do it again and again. But over time, the Lord began to use it. So you can't really look at a one or two sort of occurrence that, you know, well, it didn't work.
Yep.
One more thing I want to say, because I know we're out of time, is what you mentioned about those three categories. You said willful disobedience. I forgot what.
Lying.
Lying. What's yep. the comment about that? You need to take lying very seriously.
Yep.
Just think about it. If they get good at lying with no consequences, that's going to be a very skilled cover-up of other things they learn to do. That's why lying is so dangerous. You got to take that seriously.
Does manipulation fall into that lying category?
Yes, it is. It's a little harder to measure. You know, be careful about judging motives.
Right.
We're told not to judge motives in Scripture. So if I don't know clear-cut what's going on, live to fight another day. It'll happen again.
Yep.
It'll be more clear next time.
I would
manipulation is sinful.
Yep. Last thing on the practical side, as Carrie was talking about the anger, on the practical side, sometimes I do want to examine, am I responding in anger? So like sometimes I'll realize, oh, that's actually what's also stoking the fire. The other thing is sometimes I'll say, you need to go to this place and stay there and then give them some time. Typically it's an older child, and then tell them I'm coming back in a few minutes. And then give the consequence. Sometimes that they just need that time, like as opposed to right away. That sometimes
so it also fits with our church here, middle school and high school. We try, we're not perfect in it either, but I try to be consistent with it. I refer to them as young adults. So once a child reaches middle school, I know they're not acting like a real adult. They're junior high kids. Middle school and high, but from that point on, so whatever that is, 12 or 13, I mean, the Bible only knows two kinds of people, child and adult. And around 12 or 13, they were called adults, you know, from then on. So I kind of want to foster that attitude in them and refer to them as young adults. And so raise the bar up and expect more. And I'm saying this in connection with spanking. That's another reason for us. It is based upon the child. Each child is different. But somewhere in, I think I said before, but somewhere in the, you know, the 6 to 10 range, depending on the child, it started tapering off. We just weren't doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. Other consequences. And one of the reasons is you're moving toward, I don't spank adults, you know. And so they're young adults, and I wanna treat them that way, speak to them that way, and the consequences are going to be more sophisticated.
Yep. All right, go get your kiddos.